you, Kayla. Thanks to everybody for coming during your lunch hour to listen to this talk. Can everybody hear me okay? I'm going to be boring and read my paper, but before I start reading my paper, I just want to say a few words about how I arrived at this topic. I'm a philosopher. I write about old dead people. I don't think much about this topic. But a few years ago, in 2016, many of you remember, there was the Women's March, and there was some discussion immediately before the Women's March about, because a few days before the march, some pro-life feminist groups were, they had their sponsorship, they were co-sponsors of the Women's March, and they had their sponsorship revoked. And there was some discussion about that, about, at the time, a national discussion about whether or not one could call oneself pro-life and also call oneself at the same time a feminist. And I remember, I said to a friend of mine who runs an institute at Catholic U, I said, well, we're a university, we ought to be discussing this. You know, we could invite pro-life feminists, pro-choice feminists, and they could discuss this. And we should do this. And he said, you're right, that's a great idea. You organize it, I'll pay for it. And so I organized it. And I had this funny experience organizing the discussion. Because going into it, I sort of thought the answer to the question was obvious. And coming out of it, I felt like I understood the pro-choice feminist position better than I understood the pro-life feminist position. And it just kind of triggered some thoughts in me. And what philosophers do when they have thoughts is they think about them and write them down. And that's how this paper originated. So now I'm going to be boring and read, and then we can talk at the end. In January of 2016, women marched in locations throughout the United States, but primarily in Washington, D.C., to protest the inauguration of Donald Trump. The organizers of what became known as the Women's March made a deliberate attempt to be inclusive. They envisioned a march for all women, a march which welcomed women of every race and creed. Perhaps with this goal of inclusivity in mind, they initially allowed a wide variety of groups, including pro-life feminist groups, to co-sponsor the event. But then, just days before the event, march organizers revoked the co-sponsorship of pro-life feminist organizations. And this sparked a national conversation. If feminism is really as inclusive as it claims to be, and if the goals of feminism truly do transcend race and creed and culture, then can't a feminist be pro-life? My initial reaction, the reaction of someone well outside the fray, was that the answer was obvious and the question insulting. Of course one can be feminist and pro-life, I thought. But in 2016, I knew about as much about feminism as I know about the temperance movement, and I thought of both in roughly the same way. In the way one thinks about battles that were fought and decided a long time ago. In the ensuing years, I thought more about this question. I understand a very little bit more about feminism, and I understand a bit more about why feminists argue that one cannot both be a feminist and oppose abortion. And my more nuanced understanding leads me to a more nuanced point of view. I think that one can be a feminist and oppose abortion, but I think one's opposition to abortion is going to constrain and set limits on one's feminism and perhaps redefine it altogether. Because it means ascribing to a moral framework that constrains and sets limits on and redefines everything. So my goal here today is to explain how I arrived at this conclusion. I'm going to first explain why some feminists see an intimate connection between the attainment of the goals of feminism and access to abortion. And I'm going to focus on two different kinds of arguments, which you have to pardon me for labeling them because this is what philosophers do. They label things with funny names. So I'm going to call the first argument the motive argument. And the second argument, the burden argument. I want to argue that the first kind of argument, even if true, falls short of establishing a necessary connection between access to abortion and the attainment of the goals of feminism. A feminist who accepts the motive argument can still coherently oppose abortion. But the burden argument, I want to claim, does pose a real challenge to those who both support the aims of feminism and oppose abortion. And I will argue that although contemporary pro-life feminists have attempted to respond to the burden argument, their response falls short in important ways. And finally, I will propose a way forward. So before proceeding, that's what I'm going to do. But before proceeding, I want to make two disclaimers. First, my focus here is the possibility of pro-life feminism, not the morality of abortion. This is important because there are lots of ways of arguing for or against abortion. But some feminists, both pro-life and pro-choice, want to make a very specific claim, namely that the goals of feminism in and of themselves necessitate a conclusion about whether legal access to abortion is a good or a bad thing. Pro-choice feminists believe that access to safe and legal abortion is essential to the attainment of the goals of feminism. Pro-life feminists disagree. Indeed, some pro-life feminists go even further and insist that abortion is antithetical to the goals of feminism. So that's what I'm discussing here today. Second, I want to acknowledge at the outset the difficulties inherent in any attempt to describe the feminist position on anything. If you look up feminism in the dictionary, you'll read that feminism is a movement that seeks the political, social, and economic equality of women. And that sounds well and good, until you try to pin down the political, social, and economic equality, what it is and what that would consist in. There's no canonical way of answering that question. Indeed, given the many and various answers, it would in some sense be more accurate to refer to feminisms than to feminism. However, I think it is fair to say that all feminists believe that there is gender inequality and that it should be eliminated, even if they disagree about what the inequality consists in and about how it should be eliminated. The feminist arguments for the necessity of abortion rights that I will consider here can be construed broadly enough to incorporate different ways of answering that question. Okay, so first I'm going to talk about what I've called the motive argument. When Alabama's recent abortion regulations were signed into law, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez unleashed a series of tweets which claimed that the new regulations were about owning women. Ocasio-Cortez alleged, among other things, that Alabama's regulations were no more than an attempt by religious fundamentalists to, quote, outlaw sex that falls outside their theology. Ocasio-Cortez's tweets are illustrative of a common feminist argument, namely that opposition to abortion is nothing more than a smokescreen for an attempt to control women and keep them in their place. This argument, which I will call the motive argument, maintains that opponents of abortion are not actually motivated by concern for the unborn at all, but simply want to police women's lives. I'm going to argue that the evidence cited in support of this argument is shaky. But what I really want to point out is that this argument, even if true, does nothing to establish a necessary connection between the attainment of the goals of feminism and access to abortion. Those who argue that abortion restrictions are at heart only an attempt to police female behavior and to keep women in their place offer three different arguments in support of the claim. First, opposition to abortion correlates closely with social conservatism. Opponents of abortion tend to be religious, vote Republican, and favor traditional gender roles. This, or so the argument goes, indicates that opposition to abortion is not an independent position, but something that stems from other views, and particularly from views about the proper role of women and notions about how a good mother should behave. Second, the motive argument point out that views about the acceptability of abortion tend to shift dramatically depending on a woman's reason for seeking it. A 2018 Gallup poll, for instance, reported that while 77% of US adults believe that abortion should be legal in cases of rape or incest, only 45% believe that abortion should be legal in cases where the child is simply unwanted. Pro-choice feminists argue that this inconsistency reveals that opposition to abortion does not really stem from concern for the child at all, but rather from judgments about the behavior of the woman seeking the abortion. When the woman is perceived as a guiltless victim, there is support for her decision. But when a woman is perceived as selfish, as putting her wants and needs first, her decision to end the pregnancy is viewed unfavorably. If opponents of abortion were really concerned for the well-being of the fetus, then those who oppose abortion would oppose it regardless of the mother's motive. Finally, supporters of the motive argument claim that anti-abortion legislation is primarily aimed at punishing women who seek abortions and not at helping unborn children. If legislators were truly concerned about the well-being of unborn children, then one would expect them to pass laws that would assist pregnant women and which would continue to help the child once the child was born. Since anti-abortion legislators seemingly have no interest in pursuing such legislation, advocates of the motive argument conclude that they cannot really be motivated by concern for the child at all. Now, I think that all three of these arguments are problematic. The first, in addition to making a sweeping generalization, assumes that correlation is causation. The mere fact that someone is both, say, politically conservative and opposed to abortion is no evidence that her political conservatism caused her opposition to abortion. Even if it were, it is not at all clear that opponents of abortion are exclusively Republican, religious, and socially conservative. A 2016 Slate article entitled "The New Culture of Life" proclaimed that, quote, "The future of the pro-life movement is young, female, secular, and feminist." The article itself follows several pro-life groups such as Secular Pro-Life and New Wave Feminists, which are not only vibrant and growing, but whose membership does not correlate neatly with traditional stereotypes. The second argument is more convincing because it points to a genuine contradiction in popular opinion. Belief about the morality of abortion changes based on how the child was conceived. But if abortion is murder, then the details of conception should be irrelevant. It will be as murderous to kill a child conceived by rape as it is to kill a child conceived in any other way. But popular opinion is also not always consistent. Many of those who oppose the targeting of civilians in warfare, for instance, also say that the United States' decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima was a good one. Many of those who oppose torture nonetheless say they would support its use in dramatic ticking bomb situations. It is thus possible, even probable, that many of those who oppose abortion in general, but not in the case of rape or incest, either just have conflicting moral intuitions or else think of extreme situations as a sort of moral paradox, that they think it is still wrong to kill the child, but also unjust to ask the woman to carry her attacker's child. Finally, it is unclear what legislative attempts to restrict abortion imply about the motives of those who introduce them. It is not at all clear to me that existing legislative attempts to restrict abortion do exclusively focus on punishing the women who seek them. Laws requiring a waiting period, or that the mother be fully informed, or that parents be notified of a daughter's choice, do not seem to me to be particularly punitive. But even supposing the case can be made, it is possible that those who favor such measures are simply motivated by the desire to put an end to what they perceive as an injustice. It is cheaper and easier to move to stop injustices than it is to treat the roots of a problem. And it may well be the case that opponents of abortion simply wish to use the easiest and most readily available measures. But the point I want to make about all of these arguments is that they do nothing to demonstrate a necessary connection between feminism and abortion rights. The motive argument, if successful, would only show that those who currently oppose abortion are motivated by an attempt to oppress women. It would not show that any and all opposition to abortion must be motivated by an attempt to oppress women. Many contemporary pro-life feminists, for instance, explicitly separate themselves from the religious and political affiliations traditionally associated with the pro-life movement. They agree that abortion legislation should not be punitive and that attempts to reduce abortion should focus on measures aimed at helping women and children. If a case is to be made that the attainment of the goals of feminism necessitates that women have access to abortion, then something stronger than the motive argument is needed. And in what follows, I want to examine an argument that I think is stronger, which I'm going to call the burden argument. And I want to argue that this argument does pose a real challenge to the feminist who wishes to oppose abortion, and that contemporary pro-life feminists have not done a good job of responding to that challenge. In her famous essay, A Defense of Abortion, Judith Jarvis Thompson compares what a mother does when she carries and gives birth to a child to the biblical story of the Good Samaritan. In that biblical story, a traveler, the Samaritan, comes upon a stranger who has been attacked and left for dead. Although he has no particular investment in the stranger, nor any reason to be concerned for him, the Samaritan drops everything to care for the wounded stranger. When a woman becomes pregnant and carries the child to term, Thompson argues, she is being that Good Samaritan. She is voluntarily giving her own resources to sustain the life of another, often at great personal cost. The Samaritan's selflessness, says Thompson, is certainly admirable and praiseworthy, but it is not something that society typically demands of its members. Indeed, she claims, there is only one group in society of whom Good Samaritanism is not merely expected, but demanded: pregnant women. Society demands that pregnant women put their lives on hold and endure discomfort and even danger for the sake of the child they carry. But society demands no such sacrifices of its other members, not even when the sacrifices are much smaller. And this, Thompson argues, is unfair. Thompson's paper exemplifies a certain kind of argument, which I'm calling the burden argument. The burden argument asserts that, one, pregnancy is burdensome, that, two, the burdens of pregnancy are primarily borne by women, and that, three, any society that burdens a subset of its members in a disproportionate way is guilty of an injustice. Since pregnancy is burdensome, and since legislation that restricts or prohibits abortion prevents a woman from opting out of the burden of pregnancy, it follows on this argument that a society that restricts or prohibits abortion is a society that treats women unjustly. So I'm going to examine the burden argument and the ways in which feminists who oppose abortion have tried to respond to it. I'm going to argue that it, unlike the motive argument, is not at all irrelevant. A feminist who wishes to oppose abortion must find some way of responding to it. And I will argue that although feminists who oppose abortion have tried to respond to the burden argument, they have not done so well. And finally, I will propose a way forward. So as I formulated it, the burden argument consists of three claims and a conclusion. Some will want to reject the first claim, namely that pregnancy is burdensome, outright. I think there's good reason to concede the first claim, though, at least on a certain understanding of burden. The word burden can sometimes be taken to mean bad. When someone says, I don't want to be a burden, the implication seems to be something of this sort. He or she does not want to be a dead weight with no positive value. On this understanding, a burden is just a kind of parasite that sucks the life out of its host. But there's no need to understand burden in this way. If burden is simply taken at face value, namely as a difficult undertaking, a great many things, including very valuable things, are burdensome. Friends are burdensome, families are burdensome, political office is burdensome. Indeed, one might even say that in many cases, the more valuable the undertaking, the more burdensome it will be. More importantly, although some feminists really do seem to understand childbearing in a purely negative way, not all feminists do. And if we can attribute a more charitable understanding of burden to the burden argument, then we should do so. If burden is merely taken to mean difficult undertaking, then the first two claims, namely that pregnancy is burdensome and that the burdens of pregnancy are borne primarily by women, are not really up for dispute. Pregnancy is burdensome. For some women, it is very burdensome, even a threat to life and health. For other women, it is less burdensome. But one needn't work through laundry lists of things pregnant women experience to agree with the main point. Pregnancy is hard and difficult, and it is a hardship borne primarily by women. The truth of the third claim, that any society that burdens some subset of its members in a disproportionate way is guilty of an injustice, is far from obvious. Life is burdensome, and the burdens of life are not, in general, fairly distributed. It is not obvious that a society does something wrong when it asks different subsets of society to handle different burdens. Healthy young people are expected to bear the burden of fighting for their country. The employed are expected to bear the burden of helping to care for those who are not employed. And the list goes on. So an adequate defense of the third claim would take a considerable amount of work. And we can't do that work here, but we also don't have to. Because feminism, by its very definition, seems to be already committed to at least some version of the third claim. Even understood in the most general terms, feminism is a movement that seeks to bring about equality between the sexes. This needn't commit feminism to any particular views about how social groups in general should be treated. A feminist can certainly hold, for instance, that the young and the healthy can be burdened with our country's defense, or that the healthy and the able can be justifiably burdened with the care of the sick and the disabled. But feminism, by its very definition, does seem committed to at least a restricted version of the third claim. The feminist at least seems to hold that any society that burdens women in a disproportionate way is guilty of an injustice. For the feminist believes that unequal treatment of women is an injustice, and that demanding women to bear a disproportionate burden is at least a prima facie kind of unequal treatment. So all of this should help clarify the point I asserted at the outset. The feminist who opposes abortion does indeed need to respond to the burden argument. Feminists who oppose abortion already agree that pregnancy places special burdens on women. And they already agree that society is obligated to implement measures to alleviate those burdens. It is this recognition, in fact, that is behind their advocacy of measures such as paid maternity leave, health care, and other measures aimed at helping women bear and care for their children. If they also are prepared to insist that one way of removing the burden should not be on the table, then they need to explain how that insistence is compatible with their feminism. For if a feminist, someone whose stated goal is to eliminate gender inequality, insists that an unequal burden must sometimes be borne, then it is incumbent on her to explain herself. What is feminist about insisting that women see the burdensome task of childbearing through? Pro-life feminists commonly respond by arguing that it is not the child itself that is burdensome, but other aspects of pregnancy. Women want the child, they argue, but they are forced into seeking abortion because society fails to sufficiently support them. Frederica Matthews Green, former vice president of Feminists for Life, has famously argued that abortion is always an act of desperation on the woman's part. Like an animal caught in a trap, trying to gnaw off its own leg, says Matthews Green, a woman who seeks abortion is trying to escape a desperate situation by an act of violence and self-loss. Abortion, she goes on to claim, is not a sign that women are free, but a sign that they are desperate. And Rebecca Bratton Weiss, co-founder of New Pro-Life, says that, quote, abortion happens because pre-existing injustices force women into intolerable situations. And the New Wave Feminist website, declaring that, quote, no woman ever wants to have an abortion, states that its aim is to make abortion unthinkable by making abortion unnecessary. So the pro-life feminist response to the burden argument is that it is not the child itself the woman finds burdensome, but the cold, cruel world in which some pregnant women find themselves. That women only choose abortion because they find themselves in an intolerable and oppressive situation from which abortion seems like the only escape. Some are pressured into choosing abortion by family members or partners. Others see no way to keep the child and or to carry the child and keep their job, or to carry their child and care for existing children, or etc. It is always an unhappy and tragic compromise between what the woman really wants, namely to keep her child, and the necessities of life. The truly feminist response, the pro-life feminist argues, would be to give women the help they need so they are not forced to choose something they don't want in the first place. And the side effect of doing so will be that abortion is no longer a problem. So the pro-life feminist agrees that women shouldn't be unfairly burdened. She just denies that abortion is a burden-alleviating option that women really want. Now, the claim that no woman wants an abortion has a superficial appeal, but I think it's important to consider it carefully. What does the feminist opponent of abortion actually mean when she claims that no woman wants an abortion? Want is a funny word. In one sense, in the way that no one wants to have a cavity filled or pay taxes or any other unpleasant thing, it is trivially true that no woman wants to have an abortion. In one sense, I don't want to have my cavity filled. It's painful, it's time consuming, it's generally unpleasant, and so on. But in another sense, I very much do want to have my cavity filled. Given the choice between living with the cavity and having it filled, I would choose the filling again and again and again. So if pro-life feminists are using the word want in the same way I use it, when fully intending to do it and fully believing it is the best option, I nonetheless say that I don't want to have my cavity filled, then I think their claim that no woman wants to have an abortion is true, but uninteresting. But pro-life feminists clearly aren't using want in this trivially true way, because one can concede the trivially true sense and still think that abortion is an option that women need to have. So they must mean something more robust. They must mean that women have abortions unwillingly, that they are forced into it, and they are forced into it because we as a society have failed to give them the kind of support they need, things like healthcare and maternity leave. Now, I think we can agree that this is true of many women who choose abortions, and we can agree that it is a scandal. But pro-life feminists seem to be making this claim about all abortions and all women. They seem to be claiming that no woman sees the child itself as a burden, and that it is only the necessities of life that are burdensome, and which sometimes force her with greatest reluctance to end her child's life. The most obvious problem with a response like this is that it is false. It assumes that every woman, when she finds out she is pregnant, is delighted and eager to bring that child into the world if only she could find a way, and that if she ever chooses otherwise, it is only out of desperation. And that, as one pro-choice feminist derisively puts it, is something your sweet old Aunt Sally would say. My discontent with this kind of answer crystallized for me in the summer of 2016, or 17, I think, when news networks covered Olympian Sanya Richard Ross's biography. In that biography, Richards Ross reveals that she chose to have an abortion, a decision which she says broke her. Shortly before the 2008 Olympic Games, Richards Ross discovered she was pregnant. She was engaged to be married, and is now married, and both she and her fiancé, the child's father, wanted children. But carrying her child to term would mean a missed chance at a spot in the Olympics, a goal she had spent a lifetime training to achieve. Richards Ross was at the top of her game, and missing the 2008 Olympics might mean losing her one chance at an Olympic medal. She had an abortion the day before she left for the Olympics. Now, we can blame Richard Ross's abortion on many things, but we simply cannot claim that her child died because of something society failed to revive. Richard Ross represents the supreme triumph of feminism. In what way could we change society so that choices like hers don't have to happen? Should we cancel the Olympics? Richard Ross made a genuinely hard, terrible choice, a choice no one wants to make, but it was her choice. She chose between the plan she'd always had for her life, a plan where children came after her chance at the Olympics, and the unforeseen contingency that life put in front of her. And she chose her hopes and dreams. This happens. It happens when that choice has to do with something far less glorious than Olympic gold. Women with Ivy League degrees and glamorous careers, with supportive families and husbands and plenty of financial resources, sometimes have abortions. They have them because they're not ready for the sacrifices a child requires, or because they value their independence, or the list goes on. Women have abortions because they lack jobs and health care and support, but they have them for other reasons too. And I think it is absolutely vital for the pro-life movement to acknowledge that. Why do I care so much about this? Why does it matter so much to me that the pro-life feminist argument does not accurately describe all abortions? Well, we could argue about numbers. Some people claim that as many as 78% of all abortions are chosen for socioeconomic reasons. The studies I've seen report somewhat different numbers. The most informative study I've seen, one which reviewed official state statistics across America as well as several other collected statistics, found that women report economic hardship as their primary motivation in only 20 to 40% of abortions. A whopping 48% said that they chose abortion because they felt unready for motherhood or else didn't want the lifestyle changes it would require. So much as I favor offering pregnant women the support they need, I doubt fixing our country's social woes would really diminish abortion rates by all that much. But even if the numbers panned out differently, the pro-life feminist response to the burden argument would still irritate me at a visceral level. Why? Because I think it's sentimental, and I think it encourages a sentimental view of women and the choices we make. What really leads women to keep a pregnancy that is unwanted and unplanned? A few weeks ago, I was in an Uber, and I was talking to the Uber driver. It so happens that the neighborhood I live in had very painful memories for her. She started talking about it. She told me how when she was 17, a recent immigrant, friendless, bullied by other teens in her apartment complex, which happens to be in my neighborhood, she found herself pregnant. The child's father disappeared. Her family had dreams for her, which did not include her getting pregnant at 17. And they pressured her to have an abortion. I said no, she said. I told them, you never killed me and I'm not going to kill my baby. It didn't do anything. And so she radically changed her life, driving an Uber by day, attending school at night, determined to do what she needed to do to support her son. At a party recently, a much different woman, elegant, older, successful, and happily married, told a group of us about finding out that she was pregnant again. I cried for a month, she said. She had career ambitions, she valued her free time, and she felt that she was finally beginning to emerge from the fog of motherhood, just beginning to find a little time for herself. To find that she was pregnant again was to see all of that suddenly slip away, back out of her reach. But for her, as for my Uber driver, abortion was unthinkable. And so she cried for a month, and then she dried her eyes and welcomed her child and went on with her life. Now, both of these women, each in very different ways, found pregnancy burdensome. Neither considered abortion. Economic considerations were not determinative in either case. So why did they accept the burden? I think the answer is simple. They accepted the burden because it was clear to them that it was the right thing to do. Each set aside her own plans and goals and hopes and dreams, not because they were unimportant, but because they recognized those wishes and plans were less important than the lives of the children they were carrying. Now, I have no trouble seeing the decision these women made as the right decision, but I can easily see why one might think that theirs was not a particularly feminist decision. Indeed, one can easily see it as the opposite of feminism. These women set aside their aspirations, feminist and otherwise, for the sake of something more important. Now, some pro-life feminists would disagree with me on this point. Pro-life feminists sometimes argue that the moral framework mentioned above, the view that the fetus is a child and valuable and worth whatever sacrifices bearing it entails, is itself central to, even essential to, feminism. The clearest statement of this claim is made by Sarah Foster, the former president of Feminists for Life. Feminism, says Foster, is, quote, a philosophy that embraces basic rights for all human beings without exception, without regard to race, religion, sex, size, age, location, disability, or parentage. Feminism rejects the use of force to dominate, control, or destroy anyone. Since abortion involves the destruction of human beings, Foster argues, it follows that abortion is antithetical to the aims of feminism, and that a true feminist could never support abortion. So in Foster's account, the Uber driver and the party guest were not setting aside their feminism, but fulfilling it. I think there's an insight here, but I think that Foster's claim is confusing. The problem is that it is not at all obvious to me that feminism actually is, quote, a philosophy that embraces basic rights for all human beings without exception. Feminism asserts something rather narrow, namely that there should be equality between the sexes. How does that narrow view necessitate a conclusion about the inherent value of every human being? Consider something equally narrow, like patriotism. Patriotic people believe that one ought to honor and love one's country. But one can think one ought to honor and love one's country without thinking that one also ought to love other countries, let alone that one ought to love the inhabitants of other countries. It can certainly be said, and has been said, that a true patriot would not, say, drop an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. But plenty of others have said that a true patriot would and should drop an atomic bomb on Hiroshima in the right circumstances. The question of who is correct is important, and all important, but we cannot settle it by looking more closely at the definition of patriotism. When we look at the evidence Foster cites in support of her claim that feminism is, quote, a philosophy that embraces rights for all human beings without exception, we find that it is not feminism that Foster points to, but to the other moral views that some early feminists espoused, to the fact that Mary Wollstonecraft and Elizabeth Cady Stanton opposed abortion, to the fact that Lucretia Mott and other early feminists were abolitionists, and so on. But plenty of other feminists have held opposite views. Some feminists have been racist, some have supported eugenics, and some have considered the fetus to be a parasite. A commitment to female equality is, it turns out, compatible with a wide variety of other views. Okay. So I'm going to talk now about where we go from here. I began by asking whether one could be a feminist and pro-life. I've argued that while many feminist ideals are compatible with opposition to abortion, the burden argument seems to pose a problem that pro-life feminists have not adequately answered. To oppose abortion is to believe that women are ethically required to accept the burden of pregnancy, even when that burden conflicts with things that feminists have traditionally valued, like careers and freedom. One can certainly say that given the broader moral framework in which one operates, one is ethically required to take on such burdens. But it seems more difficult to argue that it is feminist to think one ought to take on such burdens. So I'm going to conclude by proposing a way forward. In one sense, the pro-life feminist problem is easily solved. The pro-life feminist can say that when she says a true feminist must oppose abortion, she means what an advocate of just war theories means when she says a true patriot would not bomb Hiroshima, even to save her country. Namely, that feminism, like patriotism, is something that must be pursued and can only be pursued within a broader moral framework, and that it is no gain for feminism if some of its goals are achieved in ways that violate that framework. I think this is a good answer, but I also think that it will not fully satisfy the feminist opponent of abortion any more than it would fully satisfy a patriot who believes that wars should be just wars. Because what such a patriot actually believes is not that sometimes her moral framework requires her to be unpatriotic, but that her moral framework informs the very meaning of patriotism. Such a person thinks that refusing to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima would exhibit true devotion to her country. Similarly, the feminist opponent of abortion doesn't merely think that there are moral limits on her feminism. She thinks that she supports women best by saying that they should not terminate their pregnancies. A response that would fully satisfy the feminist opponent of abortion would have to unpack that belief. So I'm going to conclude with some thoughts about what such a response might look like. When I introduced the burden argument, I pointed out that burden need not be understood in a derogatory way. Life's greatest and most important undertakings are all burdensome, and they are arguably burdensome in proportion to their importance. Two things are true of undertakings that are both burdensome and vitally important. First, when only a select group of people are capable of bearing a vitally important burden, we do not see any injustice in asking them to bear it. Second, in such instances, we do not tend to see those who are asked to bear the burden for the rest of us as slaves or drudges. We see them as heroes. If you look back to the way American society viewed the young men drafted to fight in World War II, you see this. Young men on their way to war were celebrated and feted because they were taking on a great burden for the rest of us. They weren't asked to go to war because they weren't valued or because they were simply perceived as cannon fodder. To the contrary, they represented the best our country had to offer, all of its promise, and we still asked it of them. We asked it of them and expected it of them, but we still considered them heroes because we all understood the importance of their sacrifice, and everyone understood that they did it for all of us. Now, it probably does not need to be said that our society does not view childbearing and rearing as a vitally important task, and that it does not see the women who take on those tasks as heroes. The case rather seems to be the opposite. Having traveled a great deal for work when I was very visibly pregnant and also as a new mother, my takeaway is this. Almost the only ones who sympathize with you, who stop to help you, who even see you at all, are other mothers. To everyone else, you are at best invisible, at worst an obstacle that makes security lines slow and plane rides noisy. Our society seems to think of motherhood and pregnancy, to the extent it thinks of them at all, with impatience and irritation. Society does not view childbearing as a vitally important task, but I can imagine a version of feminism that would say it ought to. A version of feminism that says pregnant women perform a very hard, vitally important task, a task that demands a great deal, a task that no one else can do, a task that they do not because that is all they are good for, but rather in spite of the fact that they are also capable of so much else, just as all those promising young people put everything else on hold to defend their country. This sounds feminist to me, but I don't think that it is a view that many contemporary feminists hold, because it is a view that makes sense only if it is vitally important to take up the burden of caring for unborn life. It is a view that makes sense only to the extent that unborn life matters. Only to the extent that when you find yourself entrusted with that life, you really are required to put everything else on the back burner. If you are not, if caring for that life is a burden to be taken on only if the timing works out, or only if the child is something you happen to want, then there is absolutely no reason for society to treat pregnant women as heroes. If the life of the unborn child doesn't matter, and if you take on the burden of caring for it anyway, more fool you. So at the end of the day, this is my conclusion. Yes, you can be pro-life and be a feminist. But you will at worst have to concede that your moral framework constricts your feminism. At best, though, your moral framework might lead you to understand feminism in a different way altogether.
Dr. Noble, we're going to take about 10 minutes for questions, and if I could ask Avi to, are the food is all set up out there? Okay, so we've got wonderful food after our Q&A session, so please feel free to ask questions of our speaker. Yes?
Thanks for your talk. You unpacked very well the meaning of feminism, might mean in the context of, you know, being pro-life. But my question is, how do you unpack what it really means to be pro-life if I were to say to you, I just see that as anti-abortion, nothing more, nothing less?
So you're interested in the difference between being pro-life. So I use the word pro-life and pro-choice, and I didn't use the word like pro-abortion and anti-abortion. And you're asking me to explain how I see the difference between pro-life and anti-abortion?
Yes.
Is that? So I agree and admit that I tend to be a little careless with semantics, right? And you're right that the term pro-life is broader. So many people would argue, right? Pro-life extends not just to questions of abortion, but to questions of social justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Whereas anti-abortion is rather specific, right? So one thing you might, namely, opposition to abortion, right? Now, you could be pointing out that those are those two views, that one is narrow and one is general, or you could be saying that those two views don't intersect at all, don't necessarily intersect at all. And you might be saying the latter, that you don't really see that they necessarily intersect at all, right? Those who would argue that they do in fact intersect, right, do so because they maintain that the unborn child is a person, right, entitled to the rights guaranteed to everybody in the Declaration of Independence, right? It has a life. In the sense that is alive, in the sense that you and I are alive and has the rights that you or I expect to be given. Now that's something that I mentioned, so that's an important debate, right? And there's very interesting philosophy at stake in that debate, right? And that's something that I kind of like set to one side at the beginning of the talk, right? Because that wasn't really my focus, right? The question I want to consider is whether a person who does believe that the unborn child is alive and does have rights and should be protected can justifiably call themselves a feminist, right? So I admit that if you see those two views as completely separate, that's an important discussion. That's something I didn't discuss at all in this paper, right? So why use the word pro-life? Well, because for one thing, there are important groups of people, not small, who call themselves pro-life feminists, right? And their view is that feminism is important and that unborn children are alive and have rights and have value and are entitled to the same rights, right, as we have. And so when I use the term pro-life, I'm referring to the set of views that, that those women hold, and I'm asking whether those views are compatible with their feminism. Does it, am I answering your question at all?
Yeah, it does, but I guess, you know, something I'll take away is it becomes difficult to take in the different arguments you put forward without considering that argument, because it's in, I see it as it's very linked.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It doesn't. So, for instance, Judith Jarvis. So the burden argument, right? The one I mentioned a second, right? One thing that Judith Jarvis Thompson says at the very outset, right, is that there is this debate about the moral status of the unborn person, right? And she says it's hard. I don't think that the fetus is a person at conception. I think it becomes a person with full moral rights long before it's born. We're not going to solve that. So she's arguing in favor of abortion, right? And she says, look, I'm going to stipulate for the sake of argument that the fetus does have the same rights that you or I do. And I'm going to argue that abortion is still permissible because we cannot, it is unfair to burden a segment of society in the way that the rest of society is not, right? So I do see what you're saying. I mean, these are important questions, but I also do think they're different questions, right? If you look at the philosophy of the abortion debate, a very significant set of philosophers focus on the moral status, right? The question that you're raising. Like, is this a person? And they say, look, if you could show me that the fetus is a person like me with the same value that I have, abortion would be obviously wrong, right? But an equally large set of people, right, of philosophers who engage in the abortion debate say the opposite, right? They say, I don't care about the status of the unborn person. I don't care about its moral status. I care about imposing this burden on somebody who doesn't want it, right? And no matter how valuable that person is, you still can't ask somebody who doesn't want that burden to bear it. Right, so I do think that they philosophically these are separable, and I also think that when we consider them intellectually, I think it's important to kind of clear that ground. Right, so I'm kind of setting that the first argument, right, the moral value argument. I'm kind of setting it to one side and kind of focusing on the other side. Okay, go ahead.
So if someone were to decide to label themselves as a pro-life feminist, would you say that they then have a moral obligation to engage in the alleviation of some of the burdens associated with childbearing beyond just the level of like advocacy and voting and things like that, which everybody partakes in, but then to further engage in that burden in forms of adoption and fostering?
Sure. I think aspects of the pro-life feminist argument annoy me because I don't think they work. Right, and I think that the argument needs to be made clearer. But if you look at the work that pro-life feminists do, they're very inspiring people. Right, I mean, Destiny Herndon de la Rosa, who is the head of New Wave Feminists, I mean, she's running around collecting supplies and diapers and to take to women at the border. She's very actively and she's very wholeheartedly believes that if you want to stop abortion, then everybody needs to actively help pregnant women. Absolutely. I mean, I think if you're going to label yourself as a pro-life feminist and practice what you preach, then yeah, you should be trying to help women in whatever way possible, right? And you should be trying to make those measures available. And I think that the pro-life feminist groups, they very much do try to do that. If you look at some of their outreach, right? Their pro-life feminist groups are not at all focused on legislation, right? They think that that's a non-starter. They're primarily, in fact, focused on those other outreach opportunities.
So can
she ask? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then, if it were to follow that, like the mechanisms of imposing continuing a pregnancy be legal, then would it follow that the obligation, the moral obligation of taking on that burden then additionally be illegal, that people are legally required to take on the burden for other people in their community legally?
Oh, I see what you're saying, kind of sharing, right? Like,
right.
So here's something that I think it would be interesting to work out, right? I mean, I'm proposing that the pro-life feminism that would make sense would be a feminism that said both women are really valuable and children are very valuable, right? And I think that if you were to follow that through, that we would see it as kind of society's burden, right? Just as during World War II, we didn't just ask a bunch of people to go fight for us. We had victory gardens. We sacrificed. We collected scrap metal, right? Yeah, I think that if we were really seriously to advocate the view that I proposed at the end, we would, as a society, try to help women in every way possible. Right? And we're actually doing some of this. Is already, I mean, there are high schools now that have daycares for children, right? I mean, I think some of these, we are as a society coming to recognize that we need to help people. And it's not necessarily as a result of the pro-choice, pro-life divide, but just as a kind of recognition that we ought to help people in need, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
This was just, we have time for this one last question, so I just wanted to, sorry, go ahead.
So I have a number of questions kind of related to these guys, but I'm trying to focus on your focus, which would be feminism and not capitalism.
Sure.
So I'm curious what you would say about bodily autonomy, because from my point of view, bodily autonomy is a really important factor of feminism, mm-hmm. and being able to make a decision about what you do with your body, depending on your circumstances, regardless of the burden, at whatever situation you're mm-hmm. in, so the mm-hmm. driver versus the wealthy woman, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter, it mm-hmm. still is their decision mm-hmm. to make. Mm-hmm. How does that fall into your explanation of feminism? And I think it's anti-abortion, not the one personally, but...
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to talk about anti-abortion feminism. Like, I'm not at all attached, right, but I usually use the pro words together and the anti words together and whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
anyway, like,
significant.
Sure. I think that the bodily, I mean, I think what I have called the burden argument, right, you could as easily have called it the bodily autonomy argument. Like, I'm not sure, I mean, here is a very significant way of a very significant way of burdening someone, right, is to ask them to care for, in their body, a child that, right, a life that they don't particularly want or didn't ask to be hooked up to, right? Now, does it matter that, I mean, does it matter whether I'm burdening you by asking you to go fight in a war that you didn't ask your country to start? Or burdening you by asking you to bear a life inside your body? I mean, I don't know if that is what you are asking. Like, I don't know if you're trying to make that distinction.
Not really. I guess from my, okay, so if
yeah,
looking
sure.
at feminism as something that we're trying to create a
sure.
equality between men and women, again,
sure.
very binary,
sure.
outdated
sure.
I can't think of a situation where we require
sure.
men.
Absolutely.
We have laws that require
absolutely.
Men to get a procedure
absolutely.
Or not get a procedure or ban it, whatever.
Absolutely.
So the idea of having something be legally, about having the government have a say over
mm-hmm.
what we can do with our bodies,
sure.
in that context as women,
sure.
feels like an argument that is relevant.
Sure, absolutely.
My understanding of burden was more contextual and less kind of theoretical.
So let me back up. Like, I was trying to make the case that if feminism does, in fact, seem to come into conflict with the anti-abortion, if you will, position, right? Because feminism says that women should not be burdened in a disproportionate way. And pregnancy is a disproportionate burden. It just is, right? I'm conceding all of that. Like, I think that's absolutely true, right? And part of my point is that I don't think that the anti-abortion, if you will, cause has significantly acknowledged that, right? That maybe there, if you want to advocate feminism and oppose abortion, you have to explain why it's feminist to think that you should take on that burden, right? I can see why you might think it's moral to take on that burden, but I was saying, why would you think, right? This is what I'm exploring. Why would you think it was feminist to take on that burden? Right? And what I was proposing is, if you understand being a woman, right, as being somebody who, in addition to everything else, you're capable of, if you understand being a woman as also involving an ability to do something important that nobody else can do, then you might see yourself as morally required to take on that burden. Now, that only works, right? And I suspect this is where we would part company. It only works if you think that childbearing is a very important undertaking. And you might, I fully agree that you might not think that, but I think that.
I do think that.
Okay.
I think it's enabling people to have the choice. I think that's the.
Did you?
So inequality between all of the sexes, it's do you have the power over your body that everyone else has over their body? So it's the burden of having someone impose their power on your choice.
If it was men carrying the baby, we wouldn't even be having this.
Well, people say that, but I guess my point is the value of what it is that you're doing matters. Okay?
It doesn't have any choice.
Sure, having the choice matters, but if you were the only one, right, so pretend we're in an action movie, you're the only one who can, like, save the world, okay? Would you think that it was reasonable of the rest of society to ask you to do it? If you're the only one who can save the world, you're the only one who can disable a bomb in Times Square, the only one on the planet.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, but
there's false parallels that you're drawing here between bombs and pregnancy.
No, I'm just saying my only point is that how important the importance of what it is that is at stake is something that we weigh when we think about whether or not people should be asked to do things. That's the only point I'm making, right?
That's fair. I would just.
Right.
To say
right. So I made a very dramatic example, right? And you're like, pregnancy is not the same as like disabling. Yeah. Okay. I get it. Right. But I'm using a dramatic example to point out that if we think that the undertaking is important, we are less loath to ask people to do it. When we had to save our country from a Nazi invasion, we were not loath to ask people to go and defend their country. We're asking people to stop their lives, possibly die. We asked lots of them. We did it because we thought that what we were asking them to do was very important. And what I'm proposing, right, is that it is compatible with fully valuing women and their autonomy and everything else to ask them to carry children if the life of that child is super important and valuable. If the life of that child is not necessarily super important and valuable, then it's not feminist to ask them to care for that child. But all I'm saying is that these things are related, right? I'm just trying to make the point that those two things are related to each other and have to be related to each other. That's all.
Okay.